I am one of many specialized assassins called loopers. We eliminate people from the future. Time travel has not yet been invented, but 30 years from now, it will have been. So when criminal organizations in the future need someone gone, they zap them back to me, and I do the necessaries. The only rule is never let your target escape, even if your target is you.
I'd love for you guys to kick it off and just talk about how you guys first met and started working together for Brick.
Noah just came in. You're going to have to stop doing that. I don't mind the recording. I can't take the pictures.
All right, you started it.
Noah just came in. Our casting director on Brick, who's this lovely woman named Shannon McCannion. Where did you know Shannon from?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't.
She just brought you in. Yeah, she came in on an audition, and Shannon, because we had no money, we were just doing the auditions out of her house, so we were in, like, one of her spare bedrooms holding these auditions, and Noah just came in.
Importantly, though, I mean, it was one of my first movie auditions ever.
Which I didn't know.
And
I wasn't aware of that.
Had my inexperience been a little more apparent. No, and somebody had just, I mean, a friend of a friend of a friend of some guy who I knew said, you know, you might be interested in acting. Go, you know, here's somebody who's.
But I thought you acted as a kid. I did.
But I did commercials. I didn't do like what Joe did. I didn't. Yeah. I didn't do team sports. You know. Yeah. So it was like.
Weren't you on Saturday Night Live?
I was an extra on Saturday Night Live, in probably a dozen times.
Really?
When I was 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah.
Because I had cool parents who thought, well, this is gonna be, you know, instead of like going to Boy Scouts and going camping, he'll have the experience of going and hanging out on set, you know. Yeah. But they were they were never stage parents, you know. And when I didn't want to do it, I didn't do it. And I sort of let it kind of go at an early age, and never followed it through. Like for instance, Joe had.
Yeah. They didn't move you to LA for pilot season.
Exactly. but you know, and then it was, and I was pursuing other stuff to do with movies. I wanted to be a cameraman. And it just sort of happened that I met somebody who sent me out and, you know, introduced me to somebody who was a manager, a young guy in his 20s, who said, well, I'll send you out on some auditions, and one of them was Brick. But interestingly, you know, one of the things that happens, I think, when you get experienced or slightly well-known or whatever the case may be, is instead of having straight-up auditions, you take meetings and make note that I'm making little quotation marks right now. You take these, you know, so you'll sit down with a filmmaker and you'll have a cup of coffee and you'll, you know, kind of dance around the obvious, which is, do we want to work together or not? And you'll get to know each other and you'll get to, you know,
it's
and
like a first date. It's bizarrely like a first date.
It's like a blind date. Yeah.
I've done quite a few of these.
Here's
now.
The thing though, is that's strange. What you did that. You did that. I didn't come in and audition. I came in and met you.
No, you auditioned.
I met you, and then I auditioned.
Oh, okay.
Which is something that's very rare for both a first-time director and a first-time actor.
Right.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. And so we had sort of gotten to know each other and gone, oh, is this, you know... Because you read that
obviously,
script.
Obviously, we got to know each other quite well, because I had totally forgotten that. Obviously made a huge impression.
it did make a huge impression on me. And then I was the first guy cast in the movie.
Yeah, okay.
That's true.
And
wow,
it
that's
took
cool.
you like 9 months to put the movie. So we actually did have, we had time to become friends.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah. Yeah, it's a strange, the casting process is odd that way. But then I guess, you know, I guess you could argue that, look, if you're sitting down to cast, you know, Joe movie star and you're like an actor that's really well respected that you know, it's like, you know, do you need them to audition or can you rent the movie that you love that they're in and just see that they can do it, you know? It's
In that respect, yeah.
I don't know. It's an odd process. Yeah. Sometimes you even have to offer it before they'll even sit down. I mean, this is not about them. This is a whole dance with the agents, but sometimes you have to say, yes, we're offering you the film pending a meeting.
Yeah.
So it's
which
like,
is really just to prove that you're serious.
Yeah.
That's really just
to
prove that you're like not trying to
right.
waste.
It's kind of just
Joe movie stars. We keep saying Joe movie star, which is going to make it sound like we're talking about Joe.
Who has definitely like since Brick.
Who
is Joe movie star?
Now.
Yeah.
I mean, he's Robin now.
Be careful now. Yeah.
He's a very different guy. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, is that has the process of even though all you guys are friends, has that process just when you mix in the whole Hollywood thing and agents and all that stuff, has that become harder? Like, is it hard to get your friends, you know, in
yeah,
your
they're all now? They're all busier, so it's just yeah. I'm making those schedules work.
Present company excluded.
Present company excluded for the time being. Yeah. You're about to get busy.
After this, I feel like that's gonna be a little bit harder to get a hold of, buddy. So.
But no, luckily it hasn't. It's you know, I've been telling, well, you know, I guess Joe was the, you know, Joe and you were the two guys who, like, I've been friends with for a while that I cast in. I've been telling both of you about this movie for years and years. So,
well, I keep pulling up your spot and saying and talking about this mysteriously now lost short story.
Oh no, it's not lost. I have it.
I'm gonna put it out there. Yeah, I know you've been holding on to it.
Well, no, it spoils the ending of the movie, so I don't want to put there before the movie's out. So after that, because I wrote it as a short that I never ended up shooting, and it's actually a nice, like, 3-page short film script that has a lot of the movie in it.
We read that when we were in, like, rehearsals for Brick.
So you read it a long time ago.
I wrote it before we made Brick. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. We were at, like, 10 years ago.
And was it something that was always in the back of your mind, like, one day I'm going to make this, or did you just kind of write it and put it in a drawer and then it came back? How did Looper kind of evolve to be the movie it is?
Kind of both. I mean, Rom would always bring up, my producer, Rom Bergman, he would always ask me about it because he really liked that short and he would keep bugging me about it.
I didn't know that. Because Rom's a very, like, Rom and Ryan are they have a little Felix and Oscar thing going on.
I don't want to know who's who.
Where they compliment each other very well. Rom's very—he's very stoic.
Yeah.
He's very, you know, he's the guy behind the guy, right? And he likes being the guy behind the guy.
Yeah.
Except the guy who he's behind is himself.
It's true. It's true.
And so he does it. He's not exactly the kind of guy who I would think of as a guy who would say, you know, excited, kind of stay with this seed and keep watering.
Yeah.
So, but no, really, it just kind of sat. I mean, it wasn't like I was working on it the whole time. It kind of did sit in a drawer for like 8 years until after Bloom. And then when I pulled it out and started writing, you got to then figure out what makes it worth expanding, I guess. You know, what bigger themes can you attach to it to actually flesh it out?
And, yeah.
Because I had actually that short, Psychology of Dream Analysis, it was a short that I wrote like right in the same period as Looper that we did actually make, and it's out there on the internet. You can find it, and I tried expanding that into a feature, and I never really succeeded. I did several drafts. This company called Strike Entertainment optioned it at some point, and I did several drafts of it for them, and it just never worked. I never found like the thing that made it worth turning it from what made it work as a short into what makes it work as a feature.
Which is interesting because that was I remember after, I guess it was after I had met with you and auditioned, and we were, you know, and it was, you know, oh man, am I going to get a part in a movie, you know?
Yeah.
And also, you know, this, I didn't know any better. I figured you immediately became very good friends with the guy who hires you. So we immediately became very good friends. And it was a VHS tape 8 years ago.
Yeah.
You sent me of the short, and it is a great example of a short film that works.
Yeah.
You know, not of a short, you know, not of what you see a lot of nowadays, especially people.
See if they have an ashtray.
Oh, sure. You know, you see a lot these days of, you know, people shooting teasers.
Right.
Or, you know, I have a feature-length film and I, you know, a script and I want to make a five-minute, I want to shoot a scene from it.
Right.
And people put a lot of weight on that.
Yeah, or they do they take other movies and put together.
Right, well, that's a sizzle reel.
Yeah.
You know, that's to entice investors into saying, well, these are the people we've got in our movie, this is the vibe of our movie, this is the tone.
Yeah.
But the short film thing is you really, you know, you I've noticed, at least, especially in continuing to work with independent filmmakers and first-time filmmakers, there's a lot of pressure that is put on them to sort of try to show off what their movie is, as opposed to what Ryan and Steve did with The Psychology of Dream Analysis, which is really make a great short film that stylistically it just really reflects what they do.
Yeah.
It's a great short. I love that short. I remember I remember watching that and thinking to myself,
I think Joe has said that was the thing actually when I sent that to him, because we had had a really good meeting, but I'd never, you know, he was a little concerned just because the script is so weird, would we be able to pull it off? And I think the short was part of what convinced him to roll the dice on it. He was I think that was it's weird because it I really made it with no thought of, like, career at all. It was one of those things where it was like, we're so sick of just trying to get money for Brick all the time. Let's just make it short.
Let's just go and make something.
It's also, I mean, these days, I think everybody is so in tune. You know, really, there's been a sea change the last 10 years in terms of what people can make and how they can make it for the price and all this
well,
stuff.
Well, the other thing is, when we made it, there was no way or thought of putting it out there besides passing a VHS around.
Right.
So there was no...
Cocktail menu and beer and wine.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're in a really great time for sci-fi. I think we're in a renaissance of, like, smart sci-fi.
I think so, too.
Yeah. With, like, the stuff that Duncan Jones is doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Neil Blomkamp and, you know, those guys.
Did you see that? Were you at Comic-Con? Did you see the Elysium...
I wasn't there, but I have seen it. Yeah.
I think it's going to be cool.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So what was the kind of kernel that influenced Looper, even when it was back in the short story and then to flush it out and do a full-length feature? Like, what was... I mean, with Brick, you know, I remember you saying that you wanted to make a film noir, but, like, to make a film noir in modern... movie making, it's like either a spoof or you had to figure out a way to do it and do it seriously. So you said in high school. So what was this kind of influence to make this like time travel story?
Well, I was reading a ton of Philip K. Dick novels at the time. I kind of just discovered him, and I would just go to the store and just one after another read them all. And so I think my head was just kind of in that sci-fi idea world. But I don't know. The short has... I mean, the short basically starts with a voiceover that starts the movie.
Yeah.
Where it just explains what Loopers do. And then it's all voiceover-driven. It's similar to the Dream Analysis short. Mm-hmm. And then when the older self shows up and he lets him run, the whole short was just a foot chase between the two of them across Los Angeles. And while voiceover continues to play out about the conundrum. And it's still... and then they both end up on the beach at the end, and there's like a standoff on the beach, basically. And it had a lot of, I mean, it had kind of the same ending as the feature, and it had a lot of the same themes in the feature of kind of
selfishness.
Everything where you say the right word but it sounds wrong to you.
Yeah.
Selfishness. Just getting that weird. Yeah.
Yeah. I always have a trouble with selfless.
Self. Well, that was selfless. Selfishness versus selflessness.
Yeah.
I'm excited to put the short script out there for anyone who's interested to see it, because it is like a lot of the stuff that ended up being in the feature is baked into the short, but it didn't have Emily Blunt's character Sarah. It didn't have any of the stuff on the farm.
Yeah.
It was all about the future wife. It was all kind of on that.
So it was a kind of idea of like what would happen if you met yourself.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
And then when you did evolve it and you added more characters, and then Kid Blue came in.
Well, that's when. Adding Kid Blue and Sarah and her son and all the stuff on the farm, and kind of that's when the whole thing kind of gelled when we struck upon it. We can use this weird little sci-fi thing to amplify these themes. That's when they expanded up.
And talk about Kid Blue, because, you know, a lot of people may not know the reference, but the Kid Blue thing goes back beyond Looper. Yeah.
I just thought Kid Blue was a really cool name. I've never seen the film Kid Blue, to my shame.
Basically, my handle that I've used for the better part of 10 years,
and I stole it for this name, and now it looks like he.
I know now
his,
I look like the guy
after his character
who
in
is,
the movie.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. When it's the other way around.
It's actually the other way around.
Yeah.
I just thought it was
we'll
a
try
cool
and get that
name.
Out there so people.
All right.
I have a good friend in New York who's sort of, you know, in the same, you know, in the same sense of how I think of Ryan, a guy who I, you know, is a big brother who I look up to, who's taking care of me, and he was the guy who turned me on to the movies and are now my favorite movies. He's, you know, sort of counterculture, 60s, 70s American New Wave, the Peckinpahs, the Cassavetes, the, you know, Monty Hellman's, and Dennis Hopper, and this guy just told me to track down this impossible to find, never properly video released, you know, obscure comedic western from the 70s, and he said, man, you're gonna really dig this, you're gonna identify with this, you're gonna, and he did, and I did.
Yeah.
And and it became sort of my nickname, and, you know, I'm, you know, became into, you know, got super into westerns, against, you know, and it just became the thing that I would use. I would use online when I joined a message board. I would use on Twitter. I would use when I didn't want to use my real name.
Yeah,
you know?
And it, and, when you check into hotels.
And then I read that I get this script, you know, and I knew Ryan was working on the script, and very close enough that he would tell me he was working on the script. And
I was really lazy because I named Joe's character Joe also. I realized how lazy I was with all these
You know, I think the thing was is I still read the script, and I read Kid Blue, and Ryan had sort of, you know, I flew out to Serbia to do three lines of shtick in Bloom. You know, just you do what you're going to do for your buddies.
Right.
And you don't think about, you know, what the impact. You go, wow, I love you and you love me. Let's make movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's just something like, what can I do? What can we do together? You just, I mean, you plan and you hope that if you meet people who you really connect with, you're going to stay in each other's lives and keep working together, but you don't, who knows what that means?
Sure.
You know, who knows? And
nothing's,
you know,
guaranteed in
Hollywood. Joe just shot a movie and directed and wrote it, and I ended up doing a lot of photography for it. I mean, you know, you just do what you can do. And so even, you know,
even if that includes time traveling,
even if
pedophile
that includes,
shorts.
Yes.
Exactly. Why not?
And
have you seen that yet?
No, what is
oh,
it?
Oh man.
Some of my bumpers that I've made.
Oh really?
He's into the time travel thing right now.
But you know, Ryan sends me the script and you know, there on whatever it was, page 11.
Kid Blue.
And I read the script and I get blown away and I call him up and I go, you know, what's up with Kid Blue? He goes, well, that's you. Well, really? And he goes, well, yeah, it's Kid Blue. Yeah. And I'm like, so Joe is Joe? He's like, yeah. It's like, all right.
And Bruce is Bruno.
Bruno is, you know.
He returns at the end.
I just remember thinking, it was like, oh, this is easy. Great. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, there it is.
It's not without, like, context, because the character, I mean, anybody who's familiar.
Fancies himself a cowboy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of, yeah.
I'm probably not the first person to make this comparison, but they're similar.
They're
like they almost seem like, if we're talking about future relatives and future versions of self, they seem like your character from Brick and your character from Looper could be related.
Well,
you can tie them together a little bit.
I've now started joking that Kid Blue is Joe's great grandson.
Yeah.
It's your Tarantino linking of your universe.
Actually, I mean, I don't know why Noah's playing both those parts, but I really love. They both are kind of examples of a type of character that I particularly love, which is sort of the slightly pathetic and thus sympathetic bad guy.
Yeah.
The bad guy in quotes, I guess. And I remember, it's a weird reference to go back to, but I remember really clearly reading Beowulf for the first time, and there's that character in Beowulf of, is it Unferth, I think?
I remember, I read Beowulf while we shot Brick.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Maybe I told you about it, who has, like, the disfigurement. I forget if he has, like, some disgusting thing on his face, and he's sort of slightly pathetic, but he's also, I remember just, like, really feeling for that character, and that mixed feeling of, this guy is, you know, against our protagonist, but you see exactly where he's coming from. I mean, both of those characters have that in common.
Yeah. And there's something, I think, you know, from a sort of archetypical perspective, or even trying to
one up me with pretentiousness.
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea that a character can be dangerous and scary not based on how evil they are,
right,
or how capable they are, but how diligent they are, or how human they are, you know, how far
how they could fuck up and accidentally shoot you.
Yes, I think
that's where the threat actually comes from. It's not this guy is a badass and he's gonna mow me
down. No, it's like he's got a finger. It's like, who's got his finger on the fucking button?
Yeah.
That guy.
It's not like Sugar in No Country. It's more like, you know, this is a crazy asshole who could throw something at me at some point. I gotta kind of give this guy space.
Well, the other thing that Ryan did on both those films that I think is something that consciously or not, you know, people make comparison with those characters to is how much they're a foil for the protagonist.
Sure.
Right.
You know, which is that's a classic story move. That's a classic I'm a good storyteller move, is to put your hero, you know, help put your hero in perspective.
Yeah.
Right.
But it also makes everybody's it gives me purpose. If the idea is that, you know, I get to step in there and look at someone else, that's gonna, you know, that it's you know, you don't get a reflection that often in scripts. Usually you read a script, you read a story, and you go, oh, this is what this person's job is. in the case of Ryan's films, I end up having the opportunity to be able to either look in the mirror at the other character, or hopefully at the other character, Joe, in both cases, look in the mirror and see me.
Sure.
And so we get to dance. Yeah. We actually get to jam together.
Yeah.
It's what we like to actually sing that at each other.
I think all the characters
every day.
I think all the characters in Looper, that can be said for them. They're not necessarily, they do bad things, but I don't know if they're necessarily bad people. Yeah. They're kind of that fine line between the hero and the villain, and they make some bad decisions, and you know, especially Joe's older self, and even, I mean, you humanized, you know, your Kingpin,
right.
With Jeff Daniels. I mean,
Daniel.
We don't really get to see him play a villain, and I think you probably casted him for that reason, because he's so fatherly and likable, and, you know.
It's also not a very, he's not really a king. I mean, that's the thing, is it something that, and I actually think it's a risk that you took, was having these characters that, you know, are not the epitome of what they should be.
Yeah.
Kid Blue is not the epitome of some sort of badass assassin, and Jeff Daniels is not the epitome. Abe is not the epitome of the gangster kingpin.
Continuing the motif of me being lazy and just repeating myself, it's like Lucas and Brick, you know, it's like the kingpin is this campy guy who's actually kind of
not that, doesn't have his shit together that well. Yeah.
I saw Kid Blue as, like, you know, when you're a kid, you put on the hat and the cowboy boots and you find a toy gun and you pretend you're the bad guy.
Uh-huh. Totally,
he just never kind of grew out of that. Like, and he got a real gun, and, you know.
And got good at shooting it,
and
had somebody put faith into him, and all of a sudden,
he's still just a kid who wants to be a cowboy.
Right, yeah. Pretty much.
But, you know, what we're talking about, that's the crux of all time travel films, is, like, you know, the decisions you make and the alternates of that, and, you know, if you could go back and change things, or your older self could meet your younger self, and what wisdom that can impart.
Well, and the funny part is, you know, we keep talking about how Ryan sort of has how you've created these characters that are not the epitome of these types, you know. And yet one thing that you did sort of supercharge, one thing that you did put on steroids, was the overall theme of time travel, which is, okay, you know, what is it really about? Well, at the end of the day, it's about sacrifice. It's about regret, or the lack thereof, or about, you know, selflessness, you know, which is something that Back to the Future doesn't really touch. You know, it sort of dances.
Well, does some other themes too.
But it dances around it. That's my point. Is that good time travel movies will sort of dance around that. But it's like, that's a big idea to sort of saddle on people.
Yeah.
Awesome. Look at that.
But Looper also didn't have character making out with his mom. So,
Unfortunately.
That's a deleted scene.
That's on the cutting room floor.
Much
to my producer's chagrin.
Yeah.
Like, can't we work that in there to get the whole incest market?
Yeah. You know, kind of another running theme of all your films is kind of a self-awareness about films themselves. Like, you know, and of course, like, there's the great scene in the diner where Bruce Willis's character is like, you know, we could sit here all day and make diagrams out of straws. And then there's the line that Jeff Daniel has about, you know, you're just dressing like all the movies, which were dressing like the previous movies.
Mm-hmm.
Is that stuff just for fun, or is that kind of intentional commentary, or, like, you know?
I mean, you try and hopefully, I mean, I guess, especially when you're dealing with genre, I guess the fact that you have that shared language with the audience, that communication, that kind of meta level of communication will always be there, but you try not to consciously put it in or play it.
You don't
want to
be too on the nose. Yeah.
Well, you don't even really want to be thinking about it. You don't want your head to be in that place. I think that leads to a bad place. I think that, for instance, the line you're talking about with Jeff Daniels, where he's putting the way Joe dresses down because it is just he's copying other movies. And if that weren't organic to, I feel like you can never wink, and the way to never wink is to just try and stay as honest as you can to the reality of these characters.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the truth is, in our real lives, how often are you in a situation where you say, God, I feel like we're in Pulp Fiction right now, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This seems like a scene out of so-and-so. You know, it's something that is actually in the reality of our lives, because we live in this world that's super saturated with pop culture. And so you got to make sure it's coming from that real place of this is something the characters would actually recognize when you call it out.
And in your case, I mean, you wrote characters who would feel that way. You wrote, you know, you really, you know, you talk about foils or comparisons, you know, you compare Joe to Seth. And you go, well, here's a guy who is sort of self-aware and kind of like, you know, into some hip shit, and he's got a fucking record player, and he's got, you know, compared to the dude who's like, you know, compared to his buddy who's a poser with the slap bug, you know what I mean? Or compared to, and then you've got the kid, then you've got Kid Blues, you know, who's into this very specific antiquated world as well, you know.
Yeah, they so all kind of seem
kind
like
of established.
They
that.
All kind of seem like guys who were watching different movies and were heavily influenced. Mm-hmm.
And
they're stuff.
Yeah, and you know, there's that saying that when the society doesn't have a future, it looks to its past, and that was something I want kind of baked into the world. It's like a bleak world, so they're all kind of digging into the past for meaning. Or
I think if that was ever true, it's most true in our generation, for sure. Like,
yeah.
I don't even
know. Well, I don't know, though. I feel pretty optimistic about it right now. I feel like there is forward movement now. I feel like the way that people are, even though there is a lot of this, there is more than ever kind of a... It's almost taken for granted now. It's almost like we've gone beyond referencing stuff. It's just everything from the past is present in the matrix of kind of what makes up our lives right now. But I feel like the way people are using it now and the way that, I don't know, it sounds like such an old man thing to say, but the way that we're using the internet, or the way that the internet has accelerated the way that we process these things and integrate them into our lives is, I think, really new and really fascinating.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe now more than ever we're pushing forward in terms of how we in terms of how we live.
And I think to a degree people are using it for evolution. I mean, I remember when we're sitting here, and Ryan and I, we both like to shoot with these old style film cameras, right?
Yeah.
The Leica cameras, which are, you know, considered to be sort of the best version of these designed camera ever made, right?
Right.
And yet it's antiquated technology. But I remember when Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone 4.
Yeah.
And he said, we looked at Leica cameras.
Right.
So
yeah,
here
I remember
got,
when he
right,
said that too.
So
yeah.
Here
yeah.
you've got, you know, this sort of iconic, you know, perfect thing that doesn't really have a place in the modern world. You know what I mean?
Right.
But you've got someone looking to it and then creating something that is about as fucking, that's as fucking modern as you'll ever get.
It's
the most modern thing in the world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I think that's something that, again, that we take for granted, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
In a good way.
Yeah, that's true. Kind of going back to the whole thing about the style and stuff, your movies are always really stylish, I think. And
thanks, man.
You know, Brothers Bloom definitely had like a Fellini 8.5 vibe in terms of not only the way it looked, but the way that the characters dressed and things like that. And this movie, I'd love to talk about not only the stylistic influences with the design of the film and all that, but just the way the characters dress as well. It seems like it's got, you know, obviously that line that we were talking about kind of opens up that box. So
it's a weird thing where it's got to be, I think, especially when it's at its most extreme, which I don't think it is in Looper. In Brothers Bloom it is, but the more extreme you go with it, the more justified it has to be, the more it has to, I don't know, it's...
You're talking about when it directly, like, kind of nods to certain things?
Well, with Bloom, for instance, I guess I'm talking about, you know, it's so designed and it's so specific to that. For me, the reason that made sense and the reason it's in the movie is a very specific reason that's oriented exactly towards what the movie is trying to accomplish, which is, you know, the movie is about a guy who feels trapped in storytelling, who feels trapped in his brother's notebooks and in this world that somebody else is telling, in this kind of suffocating storytelling. And so everything that, you know, everything about the world that we create, including the way that they dress, the way that the worlds are.
I'm good, thanks.
I wanted to have that kind of, almost to an impressive degree, that overly designed type feel.
Sure.
You know? So I guess it's just a way of bringing it back to, yeah, it's fun to talk about the style and where it comes from, but it all has to be motivated by something honest.
You can't have people dressed a certain way or doing certain things or looking a certain way
without
it feeling, you know, like it's trying too hard.
So anyway, but yeah, it definitely, I mean, the influences I was drawing from for that design world were very much, you know, Fellini and 8½ and Kusturica and, you know, Terry Gilliam and all the guys who create these hyper-real spaces that feel incredibly real in their own way, but in a very subjective way that's incredibly designed, you know, so.
And for Looper?
For Looper, it was less of that. For Looper, I wanted to ground it much, much more.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring it way back to Earth because it wasn't about that so much. It was about kind of the opposite. It was about, you know, creating a future realm where we kind of felt, where it seemed recognizable, where it's about negating the futuristic elements in some way and bringing it back
down to
Earth.
Which you do a good job of explaining. I mean, you know, we don't have, you know, Joe drives his Miata,
right,
which, you know, has this sort of, you know, there is a kitsch touch to it, right? There is this nostalgic touch to it.
Right.
But then when we, you know, find out that the modern thing, that the slat bike doesn't work.
Right. Yeah.
It makes more sense that Joe drives the Miata.
Yeah,
you know, same thing with letting, you know, the fact that, you know, all the Gap men all dress the same and the character is, you know, he's sort of allowed to be a cowboy, but he's allowed to be a cowboy because he's sort of his own special category.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, you know, or even on Sarah's farm, the fact that, you know, the fact that so much shit doesn't work, and that kind of forces her to chop down the, you know, to chop the tree down by hand, you know. So, I think maybe more so than Bloom, you give more reasons in Looper, why we are the way we are stylistically.
Sure.
It still feels really timeless. I mean, there's certain times where you feel like you're in the 50s, and then there's times where it feels modern, and then there's times where it's like you can tell it's the future, but it feels like we still don't have flying cars, but everybody uses Back to the Future 2 as like this kind of litmus for like this is where we're going to be by this year. I feel like it's a lot more realistic that we'll be there in the Looper universe by 2044.
One thing that James, our prop master, has talked about a lot that made a huge impact on me was using the phrase post-manufacturing with Looper. This idea that, you know, instead of applying this dystopian society to this, you know, very classic post-apocalyptic thing, you know, the Mad Max future, we have this thing, you know, this post-manufacturing era, which is frankly very realistic. This idea that we're, you know, existing in this world where new things aren't made, and if they are, they're not good.
Yeah,
they're, you know, which is something which is you know something that people talk a lot about today.
Sure.
You know, they don't make it like they used to. You know, that kind of shit. You know.
Well, it was something that came out in the 70s with films like Blade Runner and Alien, where it was the future, but it felt dirty and it felt real.
Star Wars for me is really where that.
Yeah.
For at least for me, that was kind of the first time I remember seeing that.
The first
Star Wars where.
Yeah.
You remember
the Millennium?
That was kind of what.
Which is interesting,
and the farm that they were on feeling incredibly.
Which is interesting because I picked up on a lot, and I don't know if it was intentional or maybe it was just so in the back of your mind, but I picked up on a lot of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but was the slap bike? Does it have the Millennium Falcon sound? You know, when the Millennium Falcon tries to start up and fails, it sounds like it.
That's a good question, actually.
As soon as I heard it, I was like, that's
I think, I mean, one big connection I can see is actually in the score. I mean, Nathan, our composer, you know, he talked about looking at, you know, the sound design, looking at Ben Burtt's work on gathering real-world sounds and transforming those into the score, and that's, you know, I think that pushing it towards let's use real world sounds, let's keep it real grounded, our sound guys took their cues from the visuals, so yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And what Nathan did with that, making, you know, creating instruments, you know, which is again a very modern thing, this like modern technology that we have now where you can, you know, tell a computer to take a sound and put it on a scale and make it playable, to do that with with Foley, basically, right? Yeah. To do that with a real world sound is, again, it's like, you know, post manufacturing. It's like you're using what you have,
right?
As opposed to creating something entirely, quote unquote, new.
Yeah. Mm. And you mentioned the props. The gun designs are really awesome. Can you talk about the, because that's something that, like, there are certain parts of the film I can look at and think, like, oh, I can tell the influence here, but the gun design felt like, you know, it that felt cool. really original. It felt like you got, and again, going back to Star Wars, kind of what they did, they just went through warehouses and found random stuff.
I mean, and that's basically what we did. I mean, it was all about the design starting from the functionality of the gun. It's all about starting from, you know, okay, there's a reason, we're calling it a blunderbuss because it's just this really simple tool that you vaguely aim it at something, it's probably going to hit it. And actually, the first designs that our guys came to me with, they looked a little bit more like hemp sci-fi designed guns.
Right.
And I kept saying, less. Let's just find me an interesting piece of industrial tubing, and let's just... I think that was actually a breakthrough where I said, you know what, let's just actually have it feel like a shipping tube that you have in your hand, just with a trigger at the end of it.
Yeah.
Just as simple as that.
Still, though, it was the distillation of a shotgun.
Yeah.
So again, you're still using, I mean, you distilled the principle, and we talked about this when you were writing, you know, the distillation of what a shotgun does as opposed to what, like, a pistol does or a rifle, you know, this idea shooting shot, that it's shooting something with a wide spray, that it, you know, kind of is this, how do you distill that? And that's how you ended up with a blunderbuss, really.
Yeah.
As opposed to the other big gun, the Gat, which is what the Gatling carry, which is a the largest single-action revolver ever made. It shoots a cartridge called a .45-70, which is... usually reserved for heavy, heavy, heavy rifle munitions. It's, you know, what you would go big game hunting with.
Yeah.
And to put it in a revolver, to put it in a handgun, let alone a revolver, which is, again, an antiquated type of gun, let alone a single-action revolver, which is basically what they carried in the Civil War,
right?
It's a Colt revolver, you know, it's a... To sort of do that, again, it's using something, using a principle that exists that is very proven, and then...
Yeah.
Making it more powerful, really.
Well, I think older guns are very... I mean, they almost represent their characters for me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, your Gat is way oversized. I mean, it's like Jack, it's like Jack Nicholson at the end of Tim Burton's Batman. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's like your it's the guy who has, like, the truck that's, like, lifted huge off the ground and super loud, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And same, you know, in a different sense goes for... The blunderbuss room.
And again, even Sarah's gun, I remember, you know, you were talking about shotguns, and we actually, when you were talking about Sarah's shotgun with me, and I told you about the Remington 870, which she says in the movie, she says, that's still in the movie?
Yeah, it's still in the movie.
Where she says, there's a Remington 870, and a Remington 870 is... it's the Leica M6 of shotguns. It is this thing that is designed the same way for generations.
Yeah.
It is a perfect machine. You know, and
it's timeless,
and you know, we look at all these weapons that we have in the movie, and sort of that are all sort of these kind of, you know, they're all sort of spun on their heads a little bit, and then there's Sarah, who can chop down a tree with her bare hands, who has this perfect original tool.
Yeah,
you know,
kind of reverting back to what we were talking about, you know, with the line in the diner. I think it's a funny nod because it's like, you know, any time travel movie always gets into, like, the mechanics, and that, of course, spurs debate of, you know, and people on message boards sit there in their basements all night and argue back and forth, and you just kind of do a funny thing of, like, you know, we don't need to talk about that. Like, obviously, everybody knows the mechanics of time travel, and even, you know, you give us kind of the... And your colleague made probably one of the best time travel movies... pre-looper that we're gonna get of this generation with Primer. And you show us the machine one time, and was that always your intention, just to not ever get into it, not ever get into the technical aspect?
It was definitely something where every word that we spent explaining it was sidetracked us from what was important in the movie. But I actually But that didn't mean that I didn't want to, because I'm a time travel nerd myself. You know, I'm one of those guys who loves like thinking about all the intricacies of all the different timelines. So I, and it was really important to me that I come up with a solid foundation of rules for this movie to rest on.
Yeah.
So I did. I spent a lot of time actually coming up with how, what the logic is, the interior logic of how time travel works in this movie. And then it was just a matter of saying, but these characters are not privy to those rules. Sure. They're just going to see the effects of them.
Yeah.
And so that's all the audience is going to see. And so,
so you wrote it out and then just kind of erased it. So it was
well, not even erased it, but just had, it was actually incredibly, not just useful, but essential, because everything that happens in the movie related to time travel follows those rules.
Sure. Yeah.
It's just we don't have a blackboard scene where we talk about.
Yeah.
And so if you're actually into it, you can watch the movie and you can reverse engineer what the rules are for, you know, you can make your own list of rules and, you know, but it was, you know, so yeah, I'm always worried that line is going to indicate to real fans of the genre that that's an excuse for me to be sloppy about the time travel. It wasn't, it was just that I didn't want to spend a whole scene explaining it to the audience at that point.
Well, and I think that's a nice, I think that's a fun moment for people who are fans of the genre.
Right.
You know.
Right.
It kind of flips everything on your
head. It is definitely one of the direct addresses that you talked about earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you and Shane ever sit down and kind of talk time travel? I mean.
Yeah, I mean he.
I can watch Primer. I can literally watch Primer once a month for the rest of my life and still never understand it. I mean, it's like, it's on a whole nother level.
He really is. It really is. He read the script and we sat down and had a conversation about it, and most of the conversation was about, I don't know how much we should get into spoilers in terms of the movie, in terms of talking about it or whatever, but there's one kind of quote-unquote magical decision I made in terms of the way the time travel rules work. And the focus of our conversation was that, with him saying, well, this is a logic thing that you're sticking to that is consistent through the movie and that makes sense on an intuitive level, but just so you know, it's a slightly magical thing that it's doing. I said, I'm aware of that. I'm fine with it. So that was the main thing. That, like, and it's the thing that is, you know, the idea that the older self who comes back is in this sort of envelope of causality where anything that happens to the younger self when it happens is then reflected.
It's like a voodoo doll.
It's like a voodoo doll type thing. And that's something where it's like the picture disappearing piece by piece in Back to the Future, where it intuitively makes sense. I mean, on an intuitive storytelling level, it makes total sense.
Yeah.
And you get what's happening, and it's just like that.
Yeah.
If you actually think about it and start to pick it apart in terms of, well, is that what would actually happen, it does require a little bit of magical logic to it. But the fact that it intuitively makes sense and we stick to it through the whole thing, I felt like it was worth it.
And I know he did some effects work. What exactly did he do?
He didn't actually.
He didn't?
No, we had talked about him doing. Thank you. Originally, there was a scene in the movie that ended up being cut, where old Joe is considering giving up the quest, and he goes to throw his gun away. And as the gun is slipping from his hand, you see in his mind the memories of his wife vanishing in this kind of crystal fog.
Okay.
And we talked about him developing an effect for that, but that sequence ended up getting cut, and for logistic reasons, and also just for business ones, I decided the effects world, money-wise, is cut so close to the bone. Basically, it requires you to bid a job and then deliver it for that bid, and you have to have the resources to kind of, if you end up going back and forth with notes and spending more resources than you thought, you have to be able to absorb that cost. I just didn't want to get into a business thing like that with a friend.
Yeah.
So,
I think you do some fun stuff effects wise. You know, it's like when someone reappears and appears, we don't see like, we don't see a giant crater that has
that was a big thing. I just heard you tell that story, and it's such a good.
It's true.
Terminator probably perfected the like entry re-entry of time travel, and so you do. But I love it because it's so simple, but it works so well. And you do that with a couple of different effects in the movie.
Ryan was telling this story. Can I tell a story? Can you tell a story?
Which what? Oh, about, just the effects guys.
About specifically the people appearing in the field.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Well, no, so the effects guys would just, you know, because their job is to make something look cool, and so I'd be like, I want them to just not be there and then suddenly be there. So just no effect whatsoever, just that. And they would say, ah, cool. So yeah, they'll just not be there, then they'll be there with a little bit of a space warp around it. No, they're not there and then they're there. Yeah, right. They're not there and they're there with a little, just a little lens flare flash. No, just there.
No, it's like literally like we're filming.
How about just a nice little plume of dust?
Yeah.
Come on. No, we're filming and we stop filming and walk in.
I use that. I say it's the perfected version of what you do with your friends as a kid, where you turn the camera off and have them walk in.
Lock it off. Yeah.
I made a time travel movie when I was in high school and I did that exact same thing.
Yeah. Well, it also, I mean, it logically makes sense that that's kind of the way it might actually look if it happens.
In Primer, they just go into a box and come out again, which is even the best. It's even the more fuck you version.
Yeah.
He's like, we're going to go into this little box, lay down, and then get up again.
If you need a quote for a poster from me, you can use the fuck you version of time travel.
Full quote, Subway ads.
That's awesome. Well, you know, we haven't really started talking about this, but I think that something, as much as there is to pay attention and be wowed by in the film, the performances individually between yours and Jeff Daniels and Joe's, I mean,
I say as I zip up my fly, that I left out, thank you.
Joe's emulation of Bruce Willis is, it's I say emulation because it's not like impression would lead people to believe it's something else. Was, you know, we see a lot of movies where a known actor that's younger plays a younger version of a older known actor and they just kind of ask us to do the whole suspension of disbelief thing and maybe they kind of look like or have the same color hair or whatever, but was that more your decision or was that more Joe's as an actor to, you know, go through prosthetics and just eye color change? And
no, it was my decision. I had always thought that we would do some kind of prosthetics to him just because it's a sci-fi movie. It seemed like it'd be fun to, and because we were going for literally them sitting across the table from each other, them being the same person, it made sense to me to do something to bring it closer there. But really, it is, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, even though I'm really glad we did it, and I think it works and it creates something kind of unique, we probably could have gotten away without it just because Bruce, I realize that now that Joe's performance is really 98% of what brings it there. And
Yeah,
and you're right. He's doing this amazing thing where he's not doing an imitation. He's creating a character that lives and breathes that you could completely see as a younger version of Bruce.
I think we lucked out too in that Bruce is you know, I mean it the, you know, there's a handful of dudes that could have done that it could have been, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a handful of guys who, you know, well-known actors in their 50s that, you know, I think we lucked out in being able to have Bruce, in that Bruce does have these very iconic traits in terms of voice, in terms of look, in terms of, you know, that still make him a great actor.
Right.
As, you know, he's not resting on, he's just got, you know, he's one of these very few people that has this iconic, you know, the iconic voice and the iconic look and the squint and the shit.
Right.
You know, that I think for an actor like Joe, who is, you know, very meticulous and treats his acting, you know, like treats a performance acting performance like a musical performance, you know, in that he looks for the beats, he looks for the notes, he wants to learn how to play the instrument. Bruce is a very specific instrument.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like it
yeah.
It's
another good poster quote.
Yeah.
Bruce is a very specific instrument.
and you did an amazing thing in that you got Bruce Willis to grow his side patches out, which I don't know if I've ever seen before.
He was totally into that, yeah.
Was he really?
Into it. I think it was, like, I didn't realize, it was after the first day of shooting, I think, that our producers, like, pointed it out. And we're like, does he look older with, like, that?
It's funny how much it really changes, I mean, it's subtle, but it's funny how much it changes his look.
It really, really does. Yeah. I think it's a, I think it looks cool, but it does definitely, like, it's a very subtle thing. But
yeah.
You're right, yeah.
And what was it like, I mean, working with him, because you hear every kind of story on every kind of, you know, it is what it is, and I think a lot of times it depends on who the director is, you know, but.
I don't know. I had a great experience working. Yeah, I had kind of like the ultimate great experience. Like, if you imagine the best case scenario of what working with Bruce Willis would be like, that's kind of what it was like. He was just really into it and really just there to work, there to give the scene his all, and just there to see the script out to the and put it on the screen. So it was. And he was awesome. I had a fantastic time with him. He's such a good actor, man. Yeah. He's so fucking good.
Well, it's cool. I'm sure he appreciated getting to do something like this, too, because, you know.
I feel like he has a lot. Yeah, I mean, he does a lot of interesting parts, though. I mean, from Moonrise Kingdom to, you know, he always seems to pick. I don't know. I think you can look at the films that he picks and see what was interesting.
Which is a lot to be said for a guy that could easily, at this point in his career, just be on autopilot.
Totally, or retire at this point. Yeah. You know, the only reason that he has to do a movie is because it's something that's interesting to him.
I mean, he could literally make diehards with ridiculous titles the rest of his life and be okay.
But the thing is, he could even not do that. He could even go off to wherever, to some incredible place on some incredible island, and live the rest of his days being free. I think the only reason to even do a Die Hard movie for him is because he's excited about doing
it.
Because
it's
something that it genuinely engages him.
He seems like that kind of guy. And you guys do a couple of scenes with him, right?
I did. And my impression from Bruce and to a lesser degree, Jeff, you know, these stalwart, you know, these guys were like the pros of the pros, right? These fucking dudes who were just as good as it gets, and as, you know, and as seasoned and talented as it gets, is that, you know, if they can do one thing, and they can do a lot more than one thing, but one of the great things they can do is identify a good script, right? Yeah. And identify a good filmmaker. They've made enough movies that they meet Ryan, they read a script. Okay, fantastic. So immediately now you're getting a game from, you know, guys who are A level, right?
Yeah.
And I think what you know, this is just a theory that I have nothing that proves it other than my feeling on set, was that they saw what you can only see on a set, which is that Ryan works with his family and treats the people he works with, who are not yet his family, like they're gonna be his family. Mm-hmm. And everyone cares so much for one another as a result of that. You care for people like you would someone you're related to.
Right.
That not only is that very contagious, but I think it's something that, you know, if you've been doing this for 30 or 40 years, you see less often. You don't see that as much, you know? And I would like to think, maybe it's just wishful thinking, but I would really like to think that these guys saw that and said, you know, this is something that makes it even more special. This is something that really does give me even another reason, other than just a great script and a great director.
Right.
This is another reason to really ensure that we do this the right way, and that, you know, we are not islands. We are a unit.
Yeah.
You know, we are a family.
Yeah, it seems like
I definitely felt that, and I think, you know, it's Ryan's job to sort of, you know, obviously he's the boss, he's dad,
right?
But he's the patriarch here. But as a member, as a junior member, I definitely felt that. I felt like there was, you know, a sense of these guys. I remember maybe day two or three, I was sitting in a director's chair off of set, and Jeff was sitting next to me, and we were sort of getting to know each other a little bit and having a little small talk. And much like Bruce, he's, you know, very stoic guy, very prepared guy, very into what is, you know, and you know, into what he's got to do, and you can sort of tell he's in the zone. And it was very special, of course, to sit there and have a little bit of chat.
Shoot the shit with Jeff
you
Daniels,
know, for 30 seconds, shooting the shit with Jeff Daniels is kind of a joke, too. And Bruce walks in, and he walks right up to Jeff. And they kind of lean into one another, and they, like, you know, kind of have this, you know, sort of hushed, you know, like the language of twins, you know? You know, like some language that only dudes like that know. And at some point, I hear Bruce, and he goes, so how is he? Meaning, how's Ryan?
and Jeff goes,
oh, it looks like it's worth it.
Could have found the ride. Oh, there you go. Man.
Thanks a lot.
Jeff says, he's great. He just wants less. He just wants less. And Bruce kind of nods, and then Jeff looks over at me, and I've been sitting there wide-eyed watching these two fucking legendary dudes chew the fat together. I'm just like, and Jeff puts his arm on Bruce, and he touches my arm, and he goes, it's Bruce Willis.
And you're like, yeah,
like,
I know.
I sort of feel like it's like that's the vibe.
Yeah.
And it's like it's such a safe, good enough environment that you can all sort of have that.
Yeah.
My favorite Jeff Daniels story was we were there was a quiet moment in between set, and Jeff we didn't chat a lot. He just kind of was really focused on just doing the work, and there was like a quiet moment set between takes, and he goes, so I got one time travel question for you. And I go, okay, well, I got really excited because there wasn't a lot of chatter between us, so it was my chance to actually have a talk with him. He goes, so I'm from the future. And I go, yeah. And he goes, so does that mean I know everything that's about to happen right now? And I go, well, no, it doesn't. Because the way that the logic works in the movie is, and he raises
up... You turn into, Simpson scientist all of a sudden.
Yeah, he raises up his hand, and he goes, no is fine.
Just went back. Well, you see.
he said, we had a, you know, we have a couple of, intense scenes together, right? And the first day we worked together and did sort of an intense scene together, we kind of just did our thing, and he kind of, you know, he was kept it very stoic, you know, and then the next day that we had sort of an intense scene together, I think he realized that I was going to sort of do the same thing again, which was kind of like freak myself out for a day, because I've been preparing to do this for months and months, and I sort of don't know any other way, and he's like, listen, you know, he kind of leans into me, he's like, listen, dude, you know, when the camera's on me, you don't have to, you know, I'm not in the same place you're at, you know, and I was like already... in my weird emotional father's, and I was like, no, I'm just gonna do it. I'm just don't mess it. And I think he had a little bit of respect for that. I think he was like, oh, okay, this kid's got some fucking weird thing. He's gonna let him do his fucking weird thing.
Yeah.
And then he kind of warmed up to me. And that night, as he was leaving, we had our little dressing trailers right next to each other. And as he was leaving, I was standing outside, like, you know, still hyperventilating after the day, smoking a cigarette, and he's leaving, and he's got a fedora on and like a scarf, you know, and he's walking off into the New Orleans fog, you know, and he looks back at me and he goes, good job today, kid. We're in a good one. And I thought, well, like, and he said it with the weight of a man who doesn't always say that.
Yeah.
He said it with the weight of a man who doesn't deliver that shit.
There's something about when a guy like that calls you kid. Like, I remember I interviewed Harrison Ford, which was obviously it was the pinnacle of my life. And if I had died the next day, I would have been totally fine with it. And he called me kid, and it just was like, I all of a sudden shrunk in my clothes and became like an 8-year-old boy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And felt like Short Round all of a sudden.
That's pretty damn cool.
But, and you guys are all, you're all movie fans yourself, obviously, and you're of this generation of filmmakers and actors that, like, this line between, like, the filmmakers and the people like us who write about films and even fans and film community, and I think a big reason is because of what we were talking about earlier with the internet and Twitter and things like that, has like the red velvet rope has kind of been taken back, and so it doesn't really, it seems like the set
we snuck in, dude, we snuck into like we snuck into a fancy ass fucking party
here,
milking it nerd style.
It seems like, you know, from Brick and Brothers Bloom, and now this being your first film that is like a major studio film with more of a budget, it just seems like it just increases, not only increases what you can do, but increases that excitement. But it hasn't really changed, like, it hasn't changed the set, it hasn't changed who you guys are as filmmakers, it just, which is, I think, exactly what people who are fans of y'all's work want, is, like, when somebody's given a budget, you know, it's, like, everyone's afraid that it's, like, Dylan going electric or something, you know what I mean, and...
I don't see what the big deal is, dude. Yeah. I mean, I keep telling people this. It's like, I didn't feel like it was, other than occasionally having, you know, Bruce Willis and Jeff Daniels around and, like, a really good espresso machine.
You're just able to get people like that. I mean, you know.
But it's also, I think it's, you know, it's skewed. This is a Ryan question, because it's, you know, for me, it's like, I saw behind the curtain. I saw the wizard behind the curtain. It's like, you know. what big sci-fi, you know, what explosion, you know what I mean?
Everyone's freaked out about the whole selling out thing with something like that. And it's just dumb. I mean, it's
well,
just stupid.
Well, the truth is, though, I mean, we made, you know, we made this movie the same way, so... The same way we made The Brothers Bloom. It was a little bit more, but it wasn't much more. It was financed the same way. We didn't make it with a studio. We made it with Endgame, who we made Bloom with. And so, truth is, the production-wise, it was very similar to Bloom. You know, we had a little bit more in terms of resources, but not a ton more. It was just enough more to get the job done.
Yeah.
So, but I'd like to think that even if we had a big studio movie, it would feel similar on set. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of why we... Why we do it is just get together with our friends and tell a story we care about.
That's a
it's
super.
It's also proof of concept. Now there's proof of concept. You know what I mean? Now, now it's very easy for anybody to sort of to kind of have had, you know, you have this theory for years of your life where you go, well, I really want to, make a movie this way. I want to run a set this way. I want to make it with these kinds of people, and then you do, and it works, and so you can point at that. To anybody, you know what I mean? It's like even if a movie studio has a different way of working than, let's say, a private financier, I sort of think that you at least have more of a shot to get it your way when you say it worked.
Well, and I think that's a super special thing these days, because a lot of times it's like studios look towards directors and actors and like kind of film communities like you guys, and they're like, oh, we love that smaller thing you did, and we want you to take that same thing and import it into this big thing. Oh, well, and since we're giving you money, we're going to tell, and it's this totally prosthetized version of it. And so the fact that you were able to make a big studio movie and it not only be an original concept, which is sadly rare these days, but you got to make the movie you wanted to make, and they seemed very supportive of it, is huge, I think.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. And sadly, you know, and your one hope in that as a film fan is that happening is going to at least kind of push the door open for a few more of those to make it through, you know?
Yeah, I guess, but the thing is, I mean, we didn't, I guess also it's important to remember that we because this was similar to Bloom, it's not like we kind of threw ourselves on the mercy of the machine and somehow managed to get through unscathed or something. My producer Rom and I and our producer Jim Stern and our whole team, we did a lot of work to do things our way. It was a lot more work making the movie this way than it would have been if we had just made a deal with the studio and made it for $80 million or whatever. And so the truth is, it's a conscious choice
concept,
that you make,
right?
And you make that conscious choice and then you see it through. And I think that's, I don't know, that to me is almost the more important lesson. It's not like something like this can get through the machine. It's that you don't necessarily need to go through the machine at all. It's that you can do your thing. You just have to figure out how.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think we should wrap up proper by talking about favorite time travel movies. And Back to the Future is... You can't say that one because obviously that just just understood. And I know you're a huge Back to the Future fan because when we first met and we were talking about that movie that we met for, you were saying your major influence on the character was Marty McFly. So
Marty McFly is my when I think of a protagonist, I think of Marty McFly, and I think of a character no one would ever let me play. I think of Marty McFly. So
Back to the Future
that particular movie,
it's
you want me to play the good guy? It's Marty McFly.
It's my favorite movie of all time.
It's kind of a perfect film.
Yeah.
Other time travel movies, obviously 12 Monkeys, Primer, we already mentioned, Terminator. It's easy to forget that that's a time travel movie, but that is actually the one that I look to the most in terms of the structure of Looper. That's a really deft use of time travel. Time Bandits.
Okay.
Time Bandits is fucking awesome. What else? Time Crimes. You see Time Crimes?
Time Crimes
movie?
Is brilliant. Yes, I love Time Crimes.
That's a really terrific little mousetrap of a movie. It's kind of this self-contained. You've seen it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of this self-contained. It's almost like the perfect like Outer Limits episode or something.
Yeah.
A self-contained little kind of time travel story. Let's see. What else? What other time travel?
It's funny because it's a genre that, or a subgenre that you think there's a lot of, and then
it's
when you
like
start to think about it,
It's similar to con man movies.
Yeah, you're like, wow,
you
can count them on like two hands.
I think there's a reason. It's a real pain in the ass to work time travel into a narrative and have it work. I guess. Bill and Ted's obviously.
Bill and Ted.
I love the third
Back to the Future movie, which gets no love.
I love.
Because it's a Western.
Yeah. I love the whole trilogy.
I'm into one. I admire two. I haven't revisited three in a long
time. I love three, and, you know, I remember I reread... this is way before we started production. I'm a big Twain fan. I reread Connecticut Yankee.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it's obviously not a movie, but, you know, that is such a, that's such a great story because it kind of takes away the bigger picture bullshit that we think of when we think of, like, the back to, you know, changing your future,
right.
The fading photograph, all that
shit.
And instead it just becomes about, well, what if they had bicycles?
Yeah.
What if they had, you know, and you kind of get, it's all the icing. It's none of the, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's all the gravy, none of the meat.
Yeah.
It's all skin, you
yeah.
know? It's great.
Wow.
I love that, yeah.
Yeah, the thing in Back to the Future 2 does well is it just, and doesn't get enough respect for this, is taking an idea of a first film and then, like, making that, like, playing with that idea as the second film.
Right.
Is, you know.
It's kind of like the, if the first film is Someday My Prince Will Come from Snow White, the second Back to the Future is Miles Davis's version of it.
Yeah.
It's a continuous riff. And
yeah, it's like a different version of the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other time travel movies and I'm, like, drawing a blank. I think
we
named all of them.
A bunch of them.
Yeah, we named all of them.
Well, it's the original, The Time Machine, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What other...
You know what? I haven't seen... is Frequency a time travel movie? I haven't seen it, but...
In a way, yeah. And I guess you could... What was the Tony Scott? Was it Tony Scott or Ridley Scott? The one with Denzel Washington.
Oh, yeah, with the...
Deja Vu?
Yeah.
It was time travel.
Yeah, I guess it depending on how loosely you define.
Yeah.
I mean, do you call it Groundhog Day a time travel movie?
Yeah, exactly.
You could.
You know, because that's also that's a fantastic example of the bigger of actually using those bigger picture, you know, this idea of regret, of sacrifice, of sort of, you know, using the mechanism to change who you are, what happens for the quote unquote better.
Yeah.
But of course, it's all done in this super compartmentalized way that it's not done in this big foul swoop, but it's done in these tiny increments. It's kind of awesome.
I think if you make a time travel movie, you know, you kind of have a responsibility to make one like that and just not use it as like a, obviously it is going to be a storytelling device, but to instead use it to pose a question instead of using it as a gimmick, you know, like what if you met yourself or what, you know, like all the different questions that they could pose.
Maybe
for sure.
You ever see that Bruce Willis movie, The Kid?
I need to see that.
It's kind of great.
Yeah.
It's kind of awesome.
Self, right?
Yeah, it's his younger. Yeah,
it would. You could do like a weird Alamo Drafthouse double feature of Looper and The Kid.
I need to see it. I've never seen it.
The Kid is great. Also, I mean, do you call Big a time travel movie? I mean, did he, you know.
No, that's a body swap.
That's a vice versa. That's a body swap.
It's not a body swap.
It's like a body swap with yourself or something. Yeah. That's weird.
Body swap with yourself.
It's a self body swap.
Saturday night for me.
I've been a little lonely lately.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's awesome. I'm just gonna post this whole conversation.
Oh no.